Once again, we have this agenda that I have shown you in which we talk about the historical context, the big question, the conceptions of human development, etc. And now we have, as you can see, we have a third row, the row for Descartes. And I know that you can read this. It's probably an insult to your intelligence for me to actually read it out loud. But I would like you just to take a few minutes to review with me this chart so that you can see how much smarter we are now than we were 3 weeks ago. Remember that we had Plato, for whom the concept of human development consisted basically in escaping from the cave. Aristotle had a much different concept of human development. It consisted in developing all of your powers so that you are fully actualized as an individual, and this he called human flourishing, or daimonia. And then Descartes will have a rather different notion of what it means to be a fully realized human being. And for him, it is somebody who has moved from a naive belief to clear and distinct certainty, solid knowledge. Similarly, they had rather different, but not altogether different, models of the mind. We saw that Plato had the four levels of knowledge and the four levels of reality that referred to the different stages in the ascent from the cave. We saw that Aristotle had a notion of a model of the mind, which was basically the development of two different faculties and their sub-faculties of the soul, namely the rational and the irrational faculties, roughly the intellect and the will. We have, as you will see today, for Descartes, another sort of dualism, and it's a much sharper and harsher dualism than in Aristotle. And in his dualism, mind and body are absolutely separate substances. And we will talk in this connection about both dualism and the concept of innate ideas. So you have already perhaps seen some of the same words, such as the word innate and the word substance, that have appeared in our previous two discussions. In the method of inquiry, we had the conceptual analysis and reminiscence going back in the memory bank that Plato thought was the way we should inquire about truth. We had the discussion of logical and empirical observation in Aristotle. And now today we're going to see a much different method of inquiry. It's called analytic meditation. And it's so-called radical doubt, or sometimes it's referred to as methodological doubt, and then the famous cogito. And finally, the self and society was understood, as we know by Plato, as the three parts of the soul corresponding to the three classes of society: the intellectual part of your soul, which corresponds to the rulers; the spirit, or the courageous part of the soul, which corresponds to the soldier and guardian and police class; and then the appetitive function of the person, which corresponds to the workers. Aristotle had a much different concept of the relation to society. He saw man as inherently political, zoon politikon, a political animal, that's what he thought we were, and that civic life then is part of human flourishing. It's kind of an extension of friendship. And we all know that friendship is good. If you don't have any friends, if you're unable to make friends, we think there's something wrong with you. And if you can make friends, say you know that you have your little child at nursery school, and your little child is outgoing, and all the friends come and play with your little child. You're so happy because you think this is a sign that your little child is going to have a happy life later on. And if you have another child who is beating everybody up or getting beaten up by everybody, you worry that maybe the social sociality of the little child is going to not contribute to human flourishing. But then in Descartes, we have a much different problem. I will refer to it here as the robot problem. And I think rather than try to explain it, even in a short one or two sentence phrase, I will alert you to the fact that Descartes' notion of this relationship of the self and society is quite a bit different than the other two. So, the historical context. Well, what can we say about the historical context? Descartes was born, as you see, in 1596, just before the beginning of the 17th century. The 30 Years' War was just about to begin. He was born in central France. He was interested in various sciences and mathematics, and he had very many philosophical works, the most famous of which is probably his Méditation métaphysique. Now, what does this mean? Descartes is the father of modernity. Well, what is modernity? Do you consider yourself a modern person? You're modern. What does that mean? Do you wear these giant pants?
Maybe enlightened.
Enlightened. Well, that's right. That's absolutely right. In fact, the German word Aufklärung is probably the word that was lurking in the back of your own mind, wasn't it? Yeah. Yes?
Well, it's in the Renaissance, that means the medieval times, the dark medieval times where all the interesting ancient laws of these philosophical orders were overcome.
Yeah. That's all quite right. I'm a little frustrated because both of you gave me the right answers. I was hoping somebody would give me an answer that was roughly the same thing as saying, well, you're with your own era, you're contemporary. You keep up with the latest events and the latest fads, the latest fashions and so on. But of course, modernity in a philosophical and other cultural contexts refers to this period that reached its high point in the Aufklärung, in the Enlightenment. And it is a period in which rationality, universality of human rights and of human cognitive functions was taken for granted. The right of the individual to pursue his own ends, the liberation, which was combined, of course, with a fellowship of other people who were equally concerned for their personal rights. So we had liberty, yes, but we also had fraternity, but most important, we had égalité. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. And of course, that was a wonderful idea that caused huge amounts of bloodshed, as most wonderful ideas tend to do. Descartes himself did not start off as a philosopher. He started off as a professional soldier. But God intervened and a cannonball almost blew his leg off. I don't know, maybe that was not God. Somebody intervened. Maybe it was the guy who shot the cannon. But at any rate, Descartes had a kind of a problem being a soldier after that. And he spent a lot of time simply recovering. And although he kept his leg, he was never really healthy after that. And while he was convalescing, he started thinking about all of these philosophical questions. He sold his property to enable him. He had a little inheritance from his father, who was a minor noble in southern France. And so Descartes sold his property in order to have the time and the leisure to pursue his intellectual interests, which were both scientific and philosophical. He died of pneumonia while working as a tutor to the Queen of Sweden, who insisted on having philosophy lessons at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was cold up there in Sweden, and it was very early in the morning. And Descartes was not all that healthy, and so he did what any well-thinking person would do under those circumstances. He died. But before he died, he invented analytical geometry. And so we speak, for instance, the Cartesian coordinates. You know, the y-axis and the x-axis, ordinate and abscissa. You can blame that on Descartes. Chicago has a street grid that is lined up on the coordinates. You say in Chicago, where do you live? And they say, well, I live at 3600, that is 36 blocks north and 24 blocks west. And we know exactly where they are. Watch out for that neighborhood, and so on. So when somebody comes to Chicago, depends of course on their level of education, but we usually say, oh, you won't have any trouble here in Chicago. It's all mapped out in terms of the Cartesian coordinates. They look at you, and then you know you did it again. But those of us from Chicago are proud that we are keeping Descartes' Cartesian coordinate concept alive. He also did research in optics, astronomy, and other areas of science. He wrote a number of philosophical works, the most famous of which is the one that I've got on the board now. Descartes' big question was, what can we be sure about? What can we be sure about? And related to this big question are some other pretty big questions, or ideas at least, the innate ideas, the mind-body relationship, the sense qualities, and natural quantities. This is Descartes' big question, what can we be sure about? And that goes back to what I said in the first couple of slides, namely that his concept of human flourishing was to pursue, not human flourishing, but human development, was to pursue certainty. John Dewey wrote an amazingly profound, although seemingly simple book called The Quest for Certainty. And he wrote this in the early 1900s, and he just slammed Descartes. He didn't use any bad words, but he said that Descartes was just really going in the wrong direction. The Quest for Certainty, that was Dewey's title, but it was Descartes' big question. The Quest for Certainty was the most wrong-headed pursuit in the history of philosophy. And if he had just not written all those books and tried to do that, we'd be a lot better off. Well, thank you, John Dewey. Why do you suppose that this quest for certainty was such a big deal for Descartes? Well, this is a psychology class. And I probably would get in trouble if I did this in a philosophy class, because we're not supposed to look into the minds of the philosophers and ask what their internal commotion was that led them to have this view. But I'm among friends here, and I can take a chance here. And actually, I'm stealing this idea from a very good philosopher named Harry Frankfurt. Yes, Frankfurt. And I know Harry a little bit, not intimately, but well, and he was having some psychotherapy at the time. But he's also a scholar on 17th century philosophy, specifically Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. And Frankfurt thought that Descartes was full of anxiety, personal anxiety, the kind of anxiety that sends you to the therapist. I don't know what Harry Frankfurt's anxiety was, but he was having something. But anyway, the theory here is that Descartes was full of anxiety at the prospect of a radically disorderly universe. A universe where basically nothing made sense. Not just the existence or non-existence of God, but even 2 + 2 = 4. Well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it equals 9.5. Say, well, I can prove that it's equals 4. I'll show you. I'll do a mathematical proof. He says, yeah, but what you're using to prove to me that 2 + 2 = 4 is your intellectual power and your logic and your understanding of abstract relationships. What if that's all bullshit too? Sorry. What if our mental faculties are internally corrupt? And we just have there is no connection between the way we carve the world up and the way the world really is. So he was really frightened by that. And so he tried to develop his grand theory to show that we could be comfortable with the idea that our knowledge, for the most part, does picture what's really going on out there. Now we have to fine-tune some of this. Do you know what I mean by fine-tune? Make more precise? Fine, on the radio you have the big dial that gets you roughly there, and then you have the little dial that gets exactly the station.
Fine Einstellung,
I'll hold it up too early. I do that. So Harry's psychodiagnosis of Cartesian philosophy is that it arose out of one man's pathological anxiety over the prospect of radical disorder in the relationship between the mind and the world. Incidentally, he went on then to analyze Spinoza's philosophy and came up with the conclusion that Spinoza was also driven by anxiety, but in his case, Spinoza was terrified at the prospect of a radically disorderly Spinoza. and that the concept of the human passions being destructive of all sense of reality was what frightened Spinoza. So he had to develop a theory of human passions that was roughly analogous to the theory of human knowledge that Descartes cooked up, so that both of these guys could go to sleep at night and not have to worry about too much of a disconnect between what was inside of them and what was out there in the world. Well, isn't that interesting? Now, the edifice of knowledge. I should have waited a minute to put this cartoon up because I wanted to pick up on... What is your name, please?
Sibylla.
Sibylla? Sibyl. Sibyl, okay. Not to be confused with Charybdis. Okay, Sibyl had made made a reference to the Middle Ages. I think he referred to the Dark Middle Ages, or at least the Dark Ages. And of course, some people would say that they weren't dark at all. But at least for Descartes, they were dark. And the Middle Ages were dark, and the Classical period was also somewhat dark. And the Renaissance era wasn't all that bright either, because what we had during those times by way of a knowledge system was a lot of conjecture, a lot of just simple belief, no grounds for it, just belief, assumptions. What's this? Annahme, opinion, hearsay, rumor, presupposition, myth, superstition. Old wives' tales. Do you have this phrase in German? Do you? I hate to be sexist here, but that's the way the cartoon is written. And but the point is, this was the edifice of knowledge, and Descartes' view was roughly quelle catastrophe, sacre bleu. And so the cartoonist here is a friend of mine named Donald Palmer. I have his permission to steal his stuff. I guess that means it's not stealing, but anyway. I want to I want to let Descartes speak for himself for just a moment here, and I've got a quotation here, and I don't want Professor Lin to feel, you know, upstaged. And, you know, they say we give everybody a little job. Would you mind reading that? This is Descartes' quote, and it's a very famous quotation from which my friend Donald Palmer developed this cartoon.
In English?
Yeah. Well.
Okay. It is not customary to pull down all the houses of a town with a single sign for killing them here.
Excuse me, let me just interrupt here. In other words, we don't usually demolish an entire town, although in the United States we sometimes do, but we do, okay, well, go ahead. What do we sometimes do something
you
else.
You can demolish a whole country if you... Sorry. You're getting the wrong stuff.
Hey, you'll get no argument from me on this. And he knows
Germans, we Germans should not throw away stones, we say, sitting in a glass house.
and we shouldn't either, but the difference between you and us is that we do it anyway. We've been throwing stones.
We do it with a bad conscience.
we do it, and we can't understand why people don't love us. But I think we better just, let's kind of move on. This is getting hot.
But it often happens that a private individual takes down his own house with the view of erecting a new, and that people are even sometimes constrained to this when their houses are in danger of falling from age, or when the foundations are insecure.
And that's the point, you see, that you will tear down your entire house and rebuild it so that it will have secure foundation. And this was his goal. So now, with these introductory comments out of the way, let's talk about, in more detail, his column one, the first column, his concept of human development. And the discussion here can be divided, I think, quite conveniently into a discussion of radical doubt, the first certainty, his famous cogito ergo sum. Could we have a little roll of the drums, please? Dum, 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 dum. Thank you. challenges to the theory, because even in his own day, but especially in later times, other people have seen problems with it. But he had at least some solutions to the challenges, and then we'll get to the conclusion. And this will take us a few minutes. I hope that we can get this done within a half an hour, maybe even a little sooner. I'm going to be tempted to talk too fast. This is a temptation that I always have. You know the famous English essayist, Oscar Wilde. He said he could resist anything except temptation. I'm kind of like that too, especially when the temptation is to speak too fast. So you must slow me down, and that includes, of course, Georg. He's very good at correcting me. He's been doing it for 20 years. 25, 30 years. 30 years, eh? Yeah.
83.
Yeah. And he's not very good at it, though. I'm still talking too fast. But anyway,
I translate it. I think some of these guys might want to use that phrase for privately.
Which one?
Ich bin gegen alles gefeit, nur nicht gegen Versuchungen.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I'm Bissell Stark. Okay, now the first is radical doubt, the game of, is this a game or is it madness? Now, when I say radical doubt, I am referring to what was what Georg read just a moment ago, and I am referring to the cartoon, namely that you have to stop believing in everything. Tear the whole gebäude, the whole building down. Get rid of all of your beliefs. And then look for something that you can trust. And that means then you doubt everything. You even doubt whether you have a hand. No, that was his example. Now, some people think that this is a form of insanity, of madness. And Descartes was aware of that, and I will come back to this problem of whether or not radical doubt, ultra-skepticism, total skepticism, is an intellectual pathology. But for Descartes, it was not a pathology because it was more of a game. It had rules and it had a goal. The way it worked is that you doubt everything, and then you come up with one thing that cannot be doubted, namely the fact that you are thinking. That's what you've got, I think. Cogito. Now, cogitation, thinking, comes in many forms. It's not just thinking about philosophy or thinking about 2 plus 2 equals 4. Thinking is a generic term that could include any mental activity, such as worrying about something, hoping for something, being afraid of something, remembering something, imagining something, cooking up a lie to tell your girlfriend, cooking up an apology to tell your boyfriend, or the other way around, and so forth. So all of these mental activities are modes of thinking, cogitation. And so never mind whether what you're doing right now is profoundly philosophical, profoundly intellectual, whether it's correct or incorrect, whether it's silly or dignified. The fact is, you're thinking. And if you're thinking, then you must exist. So by God, we've got two things. We've got I think, that's the indoubtable, you cannot doubt it. Oh, by the way, what's one other thing that counts as thinking? Doubting, that's a form of thinking. So even when you're doubting that you're thinking, you're thinking. You're thinking that maybe you're not thinking. Well, you're thinking, baby. And so this is the famous cogito.
But do you know whether Descartes confined this thinking to conscious thinking, or would he also include unconscious thinking in terms of...
I don't think he has a very clear conception of the unconscious. It might be in there, but I can't. I don't think so. Yeah, he does have a worry about when you're asleep and you're not thinking what's going on there, and that's considered problematic. But anyway, notice that we use the word cogito as a noun. We speak of the cogito. In other words, we're speaking of the very performance of an individual, such as Descartes or you and me, of an individual when this individual says, I think, therefore I am. Cogito, I think, ergo I am. To say those three words, or five words in English, three words in Latin, to say those three words is to do the cogito. It's kind of like, you know, kind of like almost like a dance. It's something you do. Let me just get my notes here together. So anyway, up here, I'm going to go back just for a minute here. Doubt is a game, and the rules of the game are that first you have to find something that cannot be doubted, and then... No, first you have to doubt everything, and then you have to try to find something that cannot be doubted. And that's the goal. Now, I've got so many things I want to tell you about here, and I don't want to get out of order here. On the idea of the doubt as madness, Descartes recognized that somebody who takes this radical skeptical view of everything and tries to use it as a way of life, that is dysfunctional. That is pathological. And if you have these symptoms, namely that you're going around and you're just so skeptical of everything that you're not able to make decisions, you're not able to place loyalties into anything, then Descartes has a solution for you. It's what I call the New York solution. Forget about it. Forget about it. Forget about it. And that's the cure. So he is sensitive to the fact that there is a danger that the game version of a doubt could become a pathological affliction. Now, some philosophers have said that this is the very fact that Descartes is reduced to this kind of account, and it is a problem, that it indicates that there's too close of a similarity between his philosophy and a bad psychological functioning. And philosophers do not like to think that what they're doing is any kind of an intellectual disease. Most philosophers don't. Although we do have in the history of philosophy philosophers who will speak of Nietzsche, who spoke of philosophy as a kind of a divine madness, and Wittgenstein himself, Ludwig Wittgenstein, said philosophy was a kind of disease. But they didn't seem to think it was a bad disease. They seemed to think it was, you know, kind of neat. This cogito, I do think that it's worth having a feel for Descartes' own voice. And so let's look at this Auf Deutsch. You know, he didn't speak German. But who wants to have a go at this? Pick a victim at the random. You're so close here. Why don't you? You can see the board for you.
Aber es gibt einen, und ich weiß nicht welchen, höchst mächtigen und verschlagenen Früher, der mich wissentlich stets täuscht. Aber wenn mich täuscht, bin ich also zweifellos auf. Und täusche mich, so viel kann. Niemals wird dennoch bewirken, dass ich nichts bin, solange ich denken werde, ich sei etwas. Der hat muss, alles genügt und übergenug durchdacht, schließlich statuiert werden. Dieser Satz, ich bin, ich existiere, ist notwendig wahr, so oft von mir gesagt oder im Geiste konzipiert wird.
It really is pretty clever, isn't it? And so imagine now that Descartes is playing this game. And as I told you, the game consisted in trying to find out something that cannot be... First you doubt everything, and then you try to find something that cannot be doubted. And the way he was able to pull this off is, as I said, he used the word thinking to refer to all cognitive activities, even the very act of doubting. And so that's how he won the game. Now, I told you that I wanted to talk about not only about radical doubt and the cogito, but also the third topic was challenges that exist to the theory. And there are these three challenges that Descartes himself took up. One is the challenge of sensory illusions, then there are dreams, and then there's the hypothesis of the evil genius. The first challenge, sensory illusions. Because the fact is, there's things out there, mirages and so on, where we get it wrong. And of course, the question is whether everything is a mirage. But Descartes said, these sensory illusions, mirages, hallucinations, simple mistakes, are themselves rule-governed. Mirages are the result of some anomaly in the environment. Anomaly? How about that, Georg? Is that an okay word? Anomaly? Yeah, okay. And so, you're driving out on the Autostrada or the Autobahn, and it's a bright day. Well, let's say you're driving on the Highway 90 in the United States, and you're going across Nevada, which is a huge, hot desert. And suddenly you see water all over the highway. You say, how did that water get on the highway? But of course, it's a mirage. It's supposedly the reflection of the blue sky on the pavement because of something having to do with the thickness of the air, the density of the air in that particular climate. And so I call this an anomaly in the sense that it's unusual, but it's not really an anomaly. The laws of physics are perfectly intact. And if you know anything about the way light refraction works, and I don't, if you know anything about it, you'll be able to explain what's going on there. And similarly here, you know how this goes. You see the part of the pencil that's underwater. Why is the part of the pencil underwater seen at a different angle than the part above the water? Is there a physicist in the house? Is there somebody that had, you know, science in third grade? And so it's a perfectly, and you could make a nice chart and graph and mathematical equations. There's no real illusion here. It's a mild anomaly. Similarly here with hallucinations. The difference is that the anomaly is not in the external environment. It's rather in the internal environment. You've got some chemical problems. You've got some neurological problems. You've got some electrical problems. Or maybe, you know, you just had too much to drink. But the fact is, when you see those pink rats in the corner, you're seeing what you're supposed to see. Anybody who ingests the kind of chemicals you just got through ingesting should be seeing pink rats in the corner. If they don't, there's something wrong with them. So it's perfectly fine to have hallucinations under certain conditions. And then finally, there are simple mistakes. You know, somebody's coming down the hall. I say, hey, there's Georg. Turns out it's not Georg. It's Bob. Well, what was the mistake there? It wasn't really that my eyes betrayed me. It's that I jumped to a conclusion. I saw Georg from a long way away, and I should have waited until he got a little closer because the features were a bit blurred. But instead, being an impulsive American, I said, hey, there's Georg! And the mistake was not in the sensation. The mistake was in the judgment I made that related my sensation to some other fact of the universe, such as there's a professor out there called Georg Lind. And so, simple mistakes are different kinds of sensory illusions than hallucinations or mirages, but they can all be explained. A second challenge, though, is a little more significant, and that is the challenge posed by dreams. We have realistic dreams, you know, where you wake up and you're not sure whether it really happened. Oh, man. And you dump that somebody was, you know, in your room stealing your money, and you have to go to home. God, it's still there. Then we have fantastic dreams, you know, where you're floating up and down in the air, or you're running around without any clothes on in the aula. Well, I assume that's fantastic. And so these are not quite so connected to our everyday experience. We have dreams of mathematical judgment. You say, dreams of mathematical judgment. Well, Descartes didn't. He said, what if you're lying there dreaming that 3 plus 5 equals 112? Maybe he had that problem. How about this one? Dreams that you're dreaming. You're having a dream, you think, oh, this is terrible, the monster's on me, I must be dreaming. And then maybe you wake up and say, oh, I was dreaming, yes, good. But of course, the dream included the fact or the thought that you're dreaming. So it can get a little bit, baroque. And then, of course, dreams that someone else is dreaming of me. And I could be lying there dreaming that my sweetie is dreaming about me, and of course, that's, wish fantasy. But anyway, doesn't it make you feel better to know that Descartes worried about this too? Now, why do I have this little thing in yellow at the bottom of the page? Because I have this secret theory that hidden within all of us is a shameful secret that sometime between the ages of 6 and 16, we all worried about that maybe it's all a dream. Either we are just simply part of someone else's dream, or what we think is happening is a part of our own dream, and we're really just some big fat slob who's lying in a bed where he's been for the last 30 years having dreams. And we're not nearly as sweet and beautiful and strong and lovely as we think we are. I won't ask for a show of hands on how many think of that. But let me suggest that according to the Tom Wren theory, if you have not had this experience, there's something wrong with you. Although there's probably something wrong with you about if you talk about it too much as well. But anyway, I know that when I talk about this in a more protracted, long-winded way in my other classes, I like to play this little game, and the students, I see them looking and say, oh, yeah, you mean it was all, I wasn't crazy after all, yeah. So anyway, it is kind of amusing. Well, what about innate ideas? Now, here's the evil genius. The evil genius, if you recall, one of the challenges here is about innate ideas. What if the evil genius, while you were in embryo, see, he's an embryo, there's the umbilical cord, takes some crazy ideas. This is a Britishism more than an Americanism. A howler. Do you know what a howler is? A mistake that is so outrageous, so crazy, so stupid, that it just makes you, everybody around you say, they howl. Oh my God, they say, why could you have done that? You know, or is somebody who uses...
Hoyla.
And Hoyla? Yeah, okay, well, he's going to put a few of those in the little baby to really screw him up so that when he's born, and not just this little baby, but all little babies. So, this is a problem. How are we going to resist the possibility that there is this evil genius? Well, Descartes resisted the evil genius. He had his trump card. And what he's got here is this idea of an all-powerful demon whose goal is to deceive me about the basic structures of reality, including logic and mathematics. Perhaps, these are my notes, you'll see them on the web if you want to look at it. 2 plus 3 does not really equal 5. Perhaps the logical law of modus ponens, which you may know about, if P is true, then Q is true, P is true, therefore Q is true. Maybe that really is not valid, and so on. So, maybe there's no correspondence between the way we think and the way the world is. And so now the question is, how do you know if you're not being tricked? See, before it wasn't just, how do you know that you're not making these radically absurd mistakes? But what if you're not just having bad luck, but you're the victim of some evil genius who is systematically out to trick you? Well, Descartes has a trump card. And the trump card is, I am. Cogito ergo sum. We'll come back to this idea of innate ideas momentarily. But the reason it's important to mention here is that Descartes was smart enough to realize that just because you've had an idea from birth, just because you were born with this idea, and just because everybody was born with this idea, does not automatically make it true. We need an independent argument for the truth of this innate idea. So Descartes feels that he has established the fact that he is not being tricked. Oh, there's one little problem with this cartoon. I didn't notice it until just now. You see on the card it says, I am? Well, actually, there's more to it than just I am. Because he's able, as we'll see in a moment, to also prove that if he exists, then God must exist. And God would not let a bad, evil genius pull such nasty things on us, because God is a good God. God is our friend. And God is going to guarantee that our perceptions are valid. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll come back to the part about God. But anyway, he feels, that is Descartes feels, that we can get rid of the notion of the evil genius as far as our minds are concerned. But what about our body? And what about the rest of the world? And what about the laws of mathematics and logic and so on? Well, for these other doubts, it's clear that we need God. And so let's just move on to see how that works. God is the guarantor. What is the word for guarantor? I wrote it down here someplace. Well, garanta. Isn't there another one? The one who provides certainty? Gewissheit Gamer or something like that? Garant? Okay. Good. So the way God is figuring into all of this is that, first of all, we have an idea of God. Now, I'm not going to ask everybody who's an atheist to raise their hands, but suppose somebody were an atheist, and the atheist person in the class did raise his hand. And I said, do you believe in God? He says, no. I said, do you understand the question? He says, of course. So this person must understand what the word God means. I can say, do you believe in unicorns? He says, no, I don't believe in those either. Do you know what a unicorn is? Yeah, it's a horse that has a horn, one horn sticking out. So he knows what a unicorn is, he knows what a god is. Just doesn't believe in either one of them. Well, where did he get this idea of God? Because the idea of a unicorn, he got it from his experience of being around horses, his experience of being around cows and so on. He knows how to, you know, imagine a single horn in the head of a horse and so on. But where did he get the idea of God? And what are some of the details about this idea of God? Well, part of the idea of God, the thing that he doesn't believe in, is that God is perfect. Fully perfect. All right? Now, this God who is perfect, tell me more about this God that you don't believe in, Mr. Atheist. Mr. Atheist says, well, this guy that I don't believe in, supposedly he's perfect, and that means he's benevolent. Because, you know, if you're not benevolent, there's something imperfect about you, because evil is the absence of goodness, privation of something that ought to be there. God does not have any privations because he's perfect. So, therefore, God is perfect, he's omnipotent, he's benevolent, he's got all the advantages, he's got everything that would be a good thing to have. And so, Descartes, right, I'm launching, I'm playing Descartes, and I'm ready to kill. And I jump on and say, oh, so then this God that you have an idea of has all of the good things, but isn't existence a good thing? Yes. Well then, this God that you've just defined as having all the good things, as being supremely perfect, must also have the quality of existing. And he goes, because I just proved the existence of God.
Das ist eine freiwillige Hausaufgabe, diese überzeugende Aussage zu widerlegen.
Yeah, and we'll see you all in the Kirche on Sunday. Uh-oh, here comes trouble, yes.
You could ask, or you could consider Feuerbach's theory of projection, that you project all your inabilities to some other higher person against the God.
But Feuerbach did not have this notion that we were born with the idea of God. See? But if you assume that we are born with the idea of God, then Descartes' argument has a better chance. But you say, why should we make that assumption? Descartes' answer is because the idea of God is infinite. Where could you possibly have gotten an infinite idea of God, an infinite idea, except... We're not imagining it, we're just conceptualizing it in very abstract terms.
The second thing about we are proving the logic is trustworthy by using logic. Because it is a logic that we assume that God's coming and existence is part of being perfect, then God has existed, and they only prove.
So am I right in thinking you're saying there's a kind of a twist of Christ in here?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm just telling you what the man said. But whether you take it completely or not, it has a certain brilliance, doesn't it? He's able to, just like with the cogito itself, he's able to take something and build on it from within. And this ability to harvest from an internal concept richer and wider reaching conclusions and concepts is why some people really think that idealism and rationalism is a great philosophy. I'll take your question, sir, but I don't want to spend the rest of this.
I just wanted to say that maybe it's not a proof, as you said, but it's rather showing that how confident Descartes was in the idea.
Exactly, yeah. And as far as your point is concerned, I'm thinking someday I will write a book, and the title of the book is going to be called God is an Atheist. Because I do think there is a God, but I don't think that the God is anything that we could imagine, and I don't think that if God imagines himself, it's anything that we could ever understand. And so these ideas of God that you, I, Descartes, and the atheist over there, the hypothetical atheist, those ideas of God are totally inadequate. God will have no part of that. That's why I say God is an atheist. He doesn't believe in any of those gods. I don't think he's a Buddhist either. Sorry. But anyway, if we do have grounds to believe that there is an omnipotent and benevolent God who exists, then we have grounds to believe that there is not an omnipotent and malevolent evil genius. And for this reason, says Descartes, mathematics and logic are trustworthy. And so are the laws of science and nature, with certain qualifications that we will come to at the very end of the talk today. So more on that in a little bit. Now, I've got all these papers here. But anyway, the point is that Descartes, thanks to this argument, by the way, that argument is very famous. It's called the ontological argument. It was first invented by Anselm in the 7th century. And it has been the result of an awful lot of philosophical debate as to whether or not it is correct to say that God is has existence because he's got to have all good things. Someone else would say, well, how about the devil? Wouldn't an existing devil be worse than... If the devil is the worst possible creature, wouldn't an existing one be worse than a non-existing devil? And so voila, we've now just proved the existence of the devil. So there are problems, yes. But anyway, within Descartes' own very, very... Descartes was a very religious man. And if I have time, I'll make a couple of little funny remarks about that. But he did take all of this. He thought this was very convincing. And one reason he thought it was convincing, I suspect, is that he knew that this particular line of argument for the existence of God had already been laid down by very famous and respected philosophers and theologians from the Middle Ages. But anyway, Looks like we have all of these good things sorted out. We've got the idea of perfections, mathematics and logic are trustworthy, so are the laws of nature. And so God exists, and so does Descartes, and the world exists too. So can we please have a round of applause for René Descartes and God? And... All right. Well, you'll be sorry. Be gone, he says. All right. But such a world. This world that we have is not quite what your mother taught you to look for in life. That things like odors and sounds and colors and tastes, these are all inside of our head. These are these are subjective qualities. They are qualities, they're not quantities. But in the external world, what do we have? In the external world, we have mass in motion. We have size, we have shape, we have location, and we have extension. And the word extension is the most important of all these words for reasons that I will explain in just a moment. But you have in some of these things, like this cubical thing, this, what do you call it, rectangle, it has a different size shape than the sphere does. But the entities in the world are really just configurations of space and time, because they are bits of mass, which is spatial, and they are in motion, which runs through time. And so, let's see. The word extension does not automatically contain within it a reference to time. But what is time except a relationship of things as they move through a three-dimensional field? You could say it both ways. You could say time is the measure of motion, and you could say motion is the measure of spatial change. But the point is, these are hopelessly abstract concepts. They have nothing to do with thought. And I can prove that very simply. You can think of yourself right now as being in Buenos Aires. I know you don't have much of a sense of what Buenos Aires is, but you know there is such a place. And you can think of Buenos Aires. You could think of, you know, your house. You could think of your dog down the hall or something like that. You can think of all these things without being there. You can have this conceptual presence to realities and locations that you are not immediately in front of. So thought overcomes space. Thought enables you to be in two places at once. And that's because thought is radically different than space. And thoughts are not spatial, and spaces are not thoughts. This desk, which could be conceived of as a surface, I'm not talking so much about the wood or whatever that made the desk up, but just this surface. And I'm talking about this surface, I'm not talking about this surface, and I'm definitely not talking about that surface. I'm talking about this surface. It's a location in space. It's a three-dimensional location in space. And it doesn't have the slightest view about where it stands vis-a-vis those other things. This surface has no idea that it is slightly lower than this other surface, and that it is off to the right or the left, depending on how you look at it, from this surface. This surface has no thought whatsoever that other surfaces exist. Thought and extension, I'm using Cartesian language now, thought and extension are utterly distinct. Ne'er the twain shall meet. If it's a thought, it doesn't have extension. If it's extended, it doesn't have a thought. Now, it's true that human beings can do both, because we inhabit both worlds. We inhabit the world of thought. We inhabit the world of extension or space. And this presents additional problems, which we will come to, now. before I leave this cartoon, let me point out one other thing. There was a physicist in the early part of the 20th century, first half, I'm not sure of his exact dates, a British guy named Eddington, Arthur Eddington. Does anybody know his work? He was influenced by Einstein, and but he was pursuing a different line of theory. But he had, as a famous example, his desk. He said, you know, a desk is not really a solid thing. A desk is a swirling mass of electrons. It's not impenetrable. For instance, if you had a fine enough stick, you could put it, run it down through in between the molecules and the electrons, and you could perhaps run it through here and come out the other side. But of course, you'd have to be very clever on this, because the swirling electrons, the electrons move so fast and so close together that it would be practically impossible. But at least, really, objectively, the desk is not solid. It's like a cloud chamber. There's just all this stuff going on. And that became known then as Eddington's desk. And then somebody else, I've forgotten who it was, Tom Jones. And Tom Jones said, okay, that's Eddington's desk, and this is my desk. And he drew this distinction between the desk that he in his personal life experiences and uses and has trust in and sometimes stubs his toe on and everything else. And then there's the Tom Jones desk, I just made that name up, and Sir Arthur Eddington's desk. And which of the two is more real? And then on they went and they had these gorgeous debates that took place during the first part of the 20th century. And they're still arguing about it. But it goes back to the Cartesian idea that in the objective world, there are these very abstract entities. And the story that we tell ourselves and each other about these entities has to do with our own consciousness. But for instance, consider odors. If a tree falls in a deserted forest, does it smell? Smell bad? Stinkus? And then there's the question, if a tree falls in a deserted forest on a mine, says it's Marcel Marceau, does anybody care? But that's not to say anything against the mind, but just to ask these questions about to what extent should we be even talking about things that happen in deserted forests, since the forest is utterly deserted. But the point is that odors are only in your perceptual apparatus. Sounds are in your perceptual apparatus, which is, of course, the point of the original joke about the tree falling in the deserted forest. Colors, say you are totally colorblind, say you have a red-green color blindness, and say you have some what is so-called normal color blindness. Let's say that you are not a person, you are a fly. And so, which one of you is seeing the world the way it really is? Just because the one of you with the so-called normal vision has more, there are more people that see the world the way you do than see the world, well no, the fly I guess has more. If they were taking a vote, there'd be more flies within there. At any rate, is this some sort of an election or a Wahlkampf where we decide what color things really are by taking a vote? Or is it simply that colors are the way you are perceiving it? A thing is after the manner of the person who perceives it. So that's what I mean by saying it's the subjective world. Okay. Now I'm moving right along here to the second of the two four columns. I'm a little bit behind schedule, but forgive me if I stumble along here. We have these two distinct but very related modes. And where's all my stuff? Here it is. I want to talk about the dualism issue and the innate ideas issue. We've already touched on both of these. But in the dualism issue, Descartes' dualism is a little different from the approaches that Plato and Aristotle had. The soul is not the substantial form of the body. Who said that? Was that Plato or was that Aristotle? No, that was actually Aristotle. Aristotle was anxious to say that the soul did not live out there in heaven, that the soul was simply the programming code of your body. And that's why, oh, by the way, you know, in that PowerPoint slide I showed you last week, the last picture where I had the scene from the Court of Athens where Aristotle's holding his hand out saying, everything's down here. Plato's got his hand up. Well, I had the names reversed. Some student was kind enough to mention that to me. Sorry about that. But anyway, Plato is pointing upwards. Aristotle's pointing downwards. And so the soul is not the substantial form that's inside the body. It's a separate substance, as it was for Plato, and also for Descartes. Now, when Plato called the soul a separate substance, well, he didn't call it a separate substance because he didn't have the word substance yet. The word substance, which literally means stands under, sub stare, stand under, was introduced by Aristotle as a way of trying to repair the damage of Plato's notion of the soul as a separate existing entity. And so to speak now of the soul or the mind as a separate substance is a little bit of an anomaly. But anyway, that's what Descartes did. He said that there were two substances, the mind substance, and by substance what do we mean here? We mean stuff, a thing, two things. And this causes problems, and Descartes then has been accused of substance abuse. But, I'm sorry. We'll come back to why he's considered to have been an abuser here. But in his dualism, the mind and the body are totally different types of reality, namely thought and extension. And that's the point I was trying to make just a few moments ago. Another way of driving this distinction home is to say that neither of these two things, thought or extension, can be conceptualized by you or me in terms of the other thing. You can't say that thought is just a very, very abstract extension. And you can't say that extension is just very, very thick thought or anything like that. No. You cannot. But there's a lot of things you can say about thought, and there are a lot of things you can say about extension. But they won't have any. What you say will not have any reference to the other domain. Now, this dualism between mind and body is famous, and there is a plausibility to it. It has a kind of a Glaubhaftigkeit, you might say. Thoughts are essentially non-spatial bodies, including human bodies, and bodies are essentially spatial bodies, including human bodies. So, like I said, there is a certain plausibility because of the terrifically different character of mind and matter. But there's a problem. The problem with dualism is this. If mind and body are utterly distinct, then how is it that they regularly interact? There are two puzzles. The body seems to influence our thoughts. Our thoughts influence our body. In the first case, bodily events, electrical changes, chemical changes, physical reactions of various things, apparently cause thoughts such as, that hurts. You know, your third grade teacher comes over and twists your ear. Your ear is now in a different position. There's electrochemical events that are going on inside your head as well as inside the ear, and but it's not just that the body is having a little commotion inside of it. The mind is thinking, hey, that hurts. And similarly, a mental event can influence or cause a bodily event. You can recall your dog's death. You can finally decide to shave your face. And all of these things cause physical phenomena to take place, such as that your blood pressure rises, tears come out of your eyes, you did love that dog, and your hand reaches out toward the razor in the sink. How can having a thought about a dog or a beard cause your arm or your tears, your eyes to tear. How does that happen? But the fact is, it does. Well, do I have an answer for you? The pineal gland. And here I will not ask for applause. This is Descartes' emergency answer. It's drawn from his own knowledge of anatomy. Do you know what a pineal gland is? Is this? And it's ganz klein. It's almost like a mathematical point, which should be something that you conceptualize in geometry with your mind. You've never seen a pure point, have you? And Descartes thought, well, this is almost like a point. It's kind of a little, it's a quasi-point. No. It's a piece of matter. It's not a point. But anyway, even if you do accept the idea that the pineal gland is a point, you still don't have a satisfactory answer for how the realm of mind and the realm of matter are connected. It would seem like there is no good solution whatsoever. Now, I have a solution. It's not mine, but I think there is a better answer, if not a total solution. And this is the answer that what is irreducible about the two phenomena of mind and matter is the way we think and talk about mental and physical phenomena, not the nature of the phenomena in themselves. And I think here Georg would agree with me, because Georg and I have both come to realize that there's an enormous story to be told neurologically, and, well, wherever else would go with neurology, chemically and so forth, to be told about our feelings of guilt, our feelings of moral responsibility, our prosociality, etc., etc., etc. And so this is the dual aspect theory, which says that when a human person does something, you can describe it in two very, very different ways. There's only one thing that the person is doing. And I don't want to say it's a physical thing. I don't want to say it's a mental thing exclusively. I want to say that this human action that you perform is capable of being described in two utterly different vocabularies. It's kind of like being able to talk two languages that are untranslatable to each other, into each other, but somehow the person knows both languages. It's like someone who has two first languages, and the person doesn't have a dictionary between them. Well, that's a theory. It's called the dual aspect theory, which I invite you to pursue if and when you get into these questions of cognitive dualism. Descartes' mode of innate ideas versus vis-a-vis Aristotle and Plato. Well, I've already tried to point to this. What I'm going to say now is a little bit redundant on earlier remarks, namely that the ideas about the world are learned from experience, and Descartes and Aristotle were at one on this view. But some of our ideas are innate, and so Descartes thought that a lot of our ideas are innate, including the ideas of mathematics and the ideas of God and the idea that I exist. Plato thought that our ideas of the abstract forms were innate. We had them, and not only did we have them when we were born, but we even had them before we were born. And Aristotle, although not a particularly great fan of the notion of innate ideas, Aristotle did think that the basic principles of rational thought were innate. That everybody, when all is said and done, everybody had the same notions. For instance, that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's one of his famous examples. And another one is what they call modus ponens. You know, if such and such is true, then so-and-so must be true. That's the first thing. But such-and-such is true. Therefore, and here comes the therefore, the other thing must be true. And to be able to glide from those, from that first sentence to the third sentence, is to be employing a principle of thought that has this fancy Latin name, modus ponens, and you were born with that rule. It's not so much an idea as it is a procedural rule. But anyway, even Aristotle thought that there was some character in our life of innate ideas. I think I left something out here. No, I guess not. Okay. Innate ideas versus what are called adventitious ideas. This is an idea, or this is a distinction that Descartes himself made. I think it's fairly important, but I don't know that we need to linger on it tonight. Innate ideas are inherently present. Adventitious ideas are derived from our experience in the world. And different people then will have different adventitious ideas. You recognize the word advent means the coming. They come to you from experience. Adventitious in English simply means it happened, but it didn't have to happen. I guess there's something. Is there a word like that in Altdeutsch? Yeah. It's more of a Latinism than anything else. Examples of innate ideas. Well, the idea of yourself as a thinking thing, the idea of God as a perfect being, the idea of causation, the ideas of mathematics, the ideas of substance, of thought, of extension. Descartes thought all of those were examples of innate ideas. Now, the third column here is method of inquiry. The method of radical doubt is definitely the one that worked for Descartes, and it works for others like him. But, as I said much earlier in the period today, it could be that this method is too bold and not appropriate for some people. You have to be careful. Radical doubt can get out of hand. And who are the people? Well, one are those who could misunderstand the purely mathematical function of radical doubt and think that it's not simply a game to be played in the quest for certainty, but it's rather an ontological, or if you wish, a metaphysical view that the world is really unknowable. That would be a mistake. But also, I can't resist thinking, there are those persons whose religious beliefs might be threatened. And we have to worry about those people. Because what if they read my book, Descartes, what if they read my book and they got the wrong idea and they stopped believing in God? Well, he said, I wouldn't want that to happen. So those people, they just shouldn't read my book. Now, why did he say this? Because about the time that he was setting down his discourses on method, and he had actually written it up in an earlier version and sent it to the printer. And he read that Galileo, who'd been saying very similar things, had just been subject to the Inquisition down in Italy. And Descartes said, in what is probably the 17th century French equivalent of, oh my God. So he ran, not walked, he ran to the printer, he said, stop the presses, give me the book back. And he wrote, he changed a few things, but then he wrote this preface, lugubrious preface. Now, this is your test. Do you know what lugubrious means? I'm not sure I do either. It means gooey. It means a real saccharine. It was, I dedicate this book to the learned doctors and bishops of the church, whose wisdom has led us to understand all that is good and true and beautiful. And if there be anything in here that does not meet with their approval, I automatically reject it because they know so much more than I. And I do realize that there are a few people who, not having the gifts of our learned doctors of the church, may misunderstand some of my theories, and in that case, they should not read the book any further, and that includes the method of radical doubt. In the American military, we have a phrase here called CYA. Does anybody know what that means, since you don't know lugubrious? It means cover your ass. And that's what you do when you want not to get in trouble, and so you invent some, you get some special authorization, you know, and so forth. It's a way of keeping out of getting scolded. Or as Descartes produced it, and here, I don't, you know what, this will be on the, on the web. You can read it here, but anyway, maybe just this one little part. My resolution is not an example which everyone should follow. That's the point. this is not an example which everyone should follow. There are some people for whom this book would not be, this method would not be wholesome. Okay, finally, the fourth column, his conception of self and society. His idea of an autonomous self really is a two-edged sword. I told you, or you and I were talking, Cyril, about this modernity part. Okay, well, part of modernity is the autonomous self. We're not encumbered with all kinds of all this tradition, all of this stuff in the edifice of knowledge, of superstitions and beliefs and old wives' tales and authoritative scriptures and so on. But we stand, we think for ourselves, we act for ourselves, we live for ourselves. And we can do this now, and we've got a philosophical justification for it, but we are alienated from other selves. Now, how can this be? How are we alienated from other selves? Well, a couple of ways. This is now talking about Descartes as the father of modernity, with his emphasis on autonomy and abstract reasoning. A bizarre example. Descartes admitted that he had no way to be sure that there were any other people in the world besides himself and God, of course. We cannot see, and by see here we mean the first level of knowledge, where you actually just, you know, see with your eyes, that others are people and not just robots, meaty robots. I mean, this gentleman up here, the one that was I don't know what he was doing. Oh, you read something for us, didn't you? Yeah, well, okay. But maybe you were just a well-programmed robot. I don't know. I mean, where is it written that a robot has to look like R2-D2 or somebody like that, and that they cannot have soft skin covering rather than tin? So maybe they're just meaty robots. So Descartes thought that the most we can do is to judge that they are people. So I don't know whether he's a robot or not. But I judge that he's not. The probabilities are that he's not a robot. The probability is that he's a person pretty much like me and you, I think. But I know that sometimes my judgments, the second order stuff, are sometimes wrong. And the ability to pass judgment on your judgments about what you see is third order knowledge. And that's the way Descartes dealt with the robot question. So this is what the world is like, and this is what the world would be like if you were surrounded by robots. Not much different. So Descartes did not have a very well-developed theory of the social life, but it's probably just as well. So much for our four columns. We just have a 5 minutes, but I'd like to spend just a little bit of time on Descartes' relevance to contemporary psychology. And Descartes, you figure somebody who is as pivotal in the history of Western thought as Descartes, you know, the father of modernity, for God's sake, he must have had some influence on even psychologists. And certainly he did. He anticipated central ideas in behaviorism and in cognitive psychology, and isn't that ironic that he's if not the patron saint, at least a very important figure in the history of both of these very very antagonistic versions of contemporary psychology. Let's talk about behaviorism first. According to and you know this. Forgive me for telling you what you already know. I'm just showing off. Yeah, I'm a philosopher, but I can talk isms. We have no access to other persons' thoughts or inner states. We can only project from our own inner experiences, or we limit our psychological inquiry to external behavior. Now, the phenomenology of the 19th century. And to some extent, Wilhelm Wundt himself was an attempt to go from your own experience to make comments on the perceptual lives of other people. But ever since Watkins and certainly B.F. Skinner, the rule was you limit your inquiry to external behavior, and you observe the way people act. And that's a, you know, there's a problem to try to observe the way people act. The temptation to start thinking about what they must be thinking is a temptation. So it's better if you just run rats. Because, you know, rats, presumably we don't have to worry about rats. Although, even there, we project onto rats. You know, they have these amazing experiments, like, you know, they put little electrodes in rats, and then the rats can choose between pushing a food bar that gives them a pellet, or pushing another bar that excites their erogenous zone of their brains. What happens? They starve to death. But, what are they thinking? Don't go there. We don't know. It's tempting to think they'd be thinking what you were thinking if you were a rat, but then again, you can't do that either. So anyway, so much for what I'm trying to say here is that we have here in a long-winded psychological theory the same point that was made with the cartoon about the possibility of people being robots. Now, in cognitive psychology, we cannot do without some version of Descartes' theory of innate ideas. I think that goes without saying if you're interested in cognitive psychology. Descartes' innate ideas enable us to act creatively. They enable us to go beyond simple mimicry to produce actions that are genuinely novel. What do I mean by that? Well, let me use for an example here Noam Chomsky, who's really a linguist, but a psycholinguist, so I guess he counts as a kind of a psychologist. And he wanted to say that we learn language by imitating people does not account for the fact that we can make up words and phrases that no one has ever uttered before. It's called the poverty of the stimulus. And so the baby learns mama, and the baby learns dada, and then the baby says, mama, mama, no dada, dada. That's never been uttered in the history of the human race, perhaps. Or if it has, that baby's never heard it. How was the baby able to cook up all of this new language from the raw materials that had been taught in this way? This is, there's more going on than just stimulus and response. This is the poverty of the stimulus theory. That is to say, stimuli are not enough to explain linguistic creativity. And finally, another story, maybe the story about the Queen of Sweden isn't quite the full story. It's said that the cafe waiter said, "Monsieur Descartes, will you have another coffee?" And Descartes said, "I think not." Boom.